So we talked yesterday about Kaluza-Klein theory and adding extra dimensions by hiding them on a relatively small scale. But I kind of kept that scale explicit just to sort of make the point that Newton's constant depended, if you like, on the volume of the compactification. So we're going to come back to that tomorrow, now that I've seen what your homework is, and talk about that a little bit more. But today I thought I would carry on the theme of black holes or black brains, talk about the Kaluza-Klein monopole, which I think is an interesting solution. It's got some sort of nice mathematics in it, as well as having some interesting physical curiosities. And then I'd like to talk about another aspect of gravity or black hole solutions in higher dimensions. It's a little bit different in four dimensions. I already commented that the topology of the event horizon was something that was different. Once you had more dimensions, it could be maybe a hole and maybe a tube. And we'll come back to that and actually just discuss whether these solutions are stable. So I'll be telling you about the Gregory-Laflamme instability, which was something that I found with Ray Laflamme, who's the director of IQC here at Perimeter. So lots of things going on at Perimeter. So there you go. Gravity at Perimeter. Not just quantum. Okay, so let me start with the magnetic black hole. So I think you did Ryson and Nordström in a tutorial or a homework or something.
Homework. Yep.
So you've seen how to put charge on an Einstein black hole. So normally we might, the only sort of charge that we might instinctively imagine would happen in four dimensions would be an electric charge. But from the perspective of the black hole, if you look at the energy momentum tensor of the Maxwell field, you see that it actually doesn't care whether the source is electric or magnetic. So what's a magnetic source? Well, the two form is basically something like a charge times the area form on S2. So it is the dual, the Hodge dual of the electric stress tensor. Maxwell's stress tensor. So that means that from the gravitational perspective, gravity doesn't care whether or not you have an electric source or a magnetic source. So it's basically the same. So why don't we routinely do magnetons as well as electrons? And the answer is that this, as a two form, it's closed, so that means df is zero. But not actually exact. Now you're going to go, hang on, F is derived from a gauge potential. I can write down a gauge potential for that. Surely I can write down A is minus Q cos theta d phi. So you think, sure, that's a gauge potential. That's the source for my magnetic monopole, but as theta tends to zero and pi, this gauge potential is not regular. It's actually singular on the axes. So you might think, well, so what? It's a gauge potential. However, remember, when you have charged particles, they couple, they sort of see the effect of the gauge potential. So if you have a charged particle and A is singular, you could have a problem. Yep.
Why is it singular?
Sorry?
Why is it singular?
Well, as theta goes to zero, A is still d phi, but the length, if you like, of dA then is going like 1 over theta squared, so it's blowing up. So since you have other fields, one of the reasons to have charge is because you've got sources, like electrons, then if you put a gauge potential that's not regular, you might have trouble. So, and of course mathematically you would say it wasn't exact if you couldn't have this nice regular setup. However, I'm just going to make this common because I need it for later. What I could do, I can certainly make my A regular on one or the other axis. So the top A, 1 minus cos theta, as theta goes to 0, 1 minus cos theta is going to 0. And so that means that my gauge potential is actually regular now on the axis. However, as I go to the south pole axis, I end up with 2q d phi, and so it's singular on the south pole axis. Meanwhile, this one is fine on the south pole axis, but singular on the north pole axis. So it seems as if we can almost construct the magnetic monopole, but not quite. So A... north is related to A south by actually a gauge transformation. So let's kind of hold some of those thoughts about, you know, the fact that Einstein gravity doesn't care whether it's electric or magnetic source, the fact that it's almost, we can almost describe it consistently with a gauge potential, but not quite. If we have two patches, if we have a north patch and a south patch, we're fine, and those two patches are related by a gauge transformation. So these are the sort of pieces of information that I've put up there. So now we're going to slot those in to our Kaluza-Klein interpretation, where our gauge potential is actually coming from the component of mixed component of a metric in an extra dimension. I'm just going to write down the five-dimensional Kaluza-Klein solution. So that's our five-dimensional Einstein metric. It's a solution to the five-dimensional vacuum Einstein equations at Cerici flat. We have a Kaluza-Klein interpretation because we have this extra dimension here, the psi, and nothing in the metric depends on psi, So we can dimensionally reduce to four dimensions by essentially deleting that second line. We see our gauge potential here. So this is our Q, is that North Pole gauge potential up at the top. And we kind of, I haven't peeled off what the scalar field is, but we can kind of see. So here's E to the 2 sigma. So it would be some related power of that for our canonically normalized scalar. But what I want to focus in on here is the fact that once again, like Reissner-Nordström, there's kind of two points in R where things happen. Now, what's different from Reissner-Nordström is this R minus is not a second horizon. You can kind of see something's a bit sick with R minus in general because you've got this R minus here. So this is not area gauge. The area of two spheres is dependent on R minus. So now, if I think about my gauge field, let's just look at the gauge field here in the context of what I just said. A is part of the geometry. So if I look at this, I don't mind necessarily if this looks singular at some particular value of a coordinate, as long as I can demonstrate that that singularity is just a coordinate singularity. So here, I've written this down so that this metric is regular at the north pole axis, theta equals zero. What I need for this to be a good, legitimate geometry is that the apparent problem that I hit when theta goes to pi, the south pole, that is simply a coordinate singularity. So I'm just going to put the caveat in. Of course, maybe we've got a singularity at R minus. But apart from that, we really don't want a singularity along one of the axes coming out from our solution. So what does that mean? Well, that means that if I can take this as being one patch, so in other words, that's on one chart, and we'll call that the N chart, because that makes it regular on the North Pole. So to get between the two, if I look what makes that gauge transformation between AN and AS, what I have to do is to change my psi coordinate. I shift it by a factor dependent on phi. So I do that so that the two A's are related in the way that I've written down on the top board. So that now means that looks okay, but obviously this has to be a sensible non-singular coordinate transformation. So both phi and psi are periodic coordinates. Psi has periodicity L, and phi has periodicity 2 pi. So what that means is, if I go around the phi coordinate, 2 pi around my phi coordinate, I better come back to the same psi, okay? So that means that 2q times 2 pi has to be an integer multiple of L. If it isn't, then that's not a good gauge transformation because it takes me from one value of psi to a different value of psi. So what that means, in essence, is that my charge is quantized. So if I fix, or if I have a given internal manifold size L, or a periodic identification, then I'm only allowed monopole charges of some sort of integer multiples of a basic unit. And this is really the reason why we tend to think about magnetic monopoles at all. So it was Dirac who first sort of explored this notion of a magnetic monopole. And of course, in his case, he wasn't thinking about gravitational solutions in higher dimensions. But instead, he was thinking about the impact of that gauge potential. And he was saying that, looking at the scattering properties of electrons if you scattered them off a magnetic monopole. Now, because we know how, I mean, I've just written it down for a scalar there, but the principle is the same. Because we know how charged particles couple to the gauge potential, that means that you can pick up phases as you go travel through some non-trivial gauge field. So if you went either side of one of these sort of singular lines of A, then potentially your wave function would pick up a different phase. And so when it's on the other side of your singular source, it would interfere and you'd get some sort of observable pattern. So that's why you don't want to have one of those gauge singularities. But Dirac discovered that if the charge of the monopole was, or well, I mean, the way he interpreted it was, if we have a charge of a monopole, then the electron can only have a multiple of a single unit charge. So in that case, he was arguing just if the existence of a single magnetic monopole in the universe implies electric charge is quantized. I've kind of gone the other way around here, talking about quantization of the magnetic charge, but it's the same thing. Once you know you've got the charge of the electron, then the magnetic monopole has to have a given charge, or vice versa. And so he found that very fascinating because previously, you know, why should electric charge be quantized? So here was a mechanism that would guarantee quantization of charge. You just had to have this sort of rather bizarre object, a magnetic monopole. So at the time, you know, it's again one of those seeds, those ideas that maybe is a little bit out there. There's no obvious justification for it, but it was still intriguing. A single monopole meant every electric charge was quantized. So here we see it, but not in the context of quantum mechanics, just in the context of geometry.
Except it's also, you know, you are saying that sort of gravity is about quantum mechanics?
No, I think here this is, I wouldn't, that's what I say, this is a purely classical argument, but the reason it's working in the same way is the geometry of the extra dimension. In gravity here, we have a circular extra dimension, and the fact that it's periodically identified is what's telling us about quantization of charge. Whereas in Dirac's case, you know, the fact that he's using the fact that electromagnetism is a U1 gauge theory and therefore has its own sort of notional circle, you know, in the sense of the U1, the representation of U1 as a circle. And so it's, this is, if you like, the the realization of this notion of quantization. And, you know, not in, I suppose his argument, this idea of the phases that you pick up going either side of a source, it's again, it is a quantum mechanical argument, but it's also, there's something global about it. It's talking about differences in paths on each side of some obstruction. And so from that perspective, sometimes quantum mechanics is not just about the small or perturbative scattering processes or, you know, strange probabilistic occurrences. Sometimes quantum mechanics can have macroscopic effects, or in this case, a global effects. And so in this case, it's taking the essentials of what's causing the quantization in Dirac's argument and saying, actually, that's coming about because of something more, you know, it's because of a global feature, and we can actually transport that global feature onto something classical and get something, in this case, deterministic. So it's not quantum mechanics, but it's the same effect.
But we are basically shifting the quantization of charge to the multi-connectedness of that internal space, right? So the question could be, like, why is this internal space a circle? Why is it not infinitely large?
Well, if it was an infinitely large line, then there would be no rationale for taking a low energy limit of gravity being effectively four-dimensional. If it's an infinitely long line, you can have arbitrarily long wavelength excitations traveling along that long line, which would then feed into five-dimensional gravitons, you know, and we wouldn't have a four-dimensional world in any sense.
Mm-hmm. Why couldn't the length of this line vary with the four coordinates?
It does, because of the scalar field. So you fix the coordinate psi, right? The coordinate psi is fixed, but the length of the psi direction is changing here. It's dependent on r minus.
That would mean that different distances from the black hole or charged quantum would be differently large.
No, because it's dependent on the underlying identification. It's the fact that the circle, it's the fact that it's a U1, not its actual size. It's the fact that it's a U1 and this, you know, this implicit identification that's going on there. So, I mean, the coordinates are fixed in this case by, you know, you see that as you go to infinity, you're in flat space, right? So that's kind of where you're fixing your normalization of lengths. You're looking at observers at infinity.
But this L is just a coordinate distance, right? So this is literally a constant, but the proper distance in d psi, this varies with r. Right?
But if you kind of look as you go to infinity, you know things that's kind of where you set your scales out at infinity. Okay, so I'm not really going to go into too much detail about the black hole side of it, but you can sort of at least see just by looking at that as r goes to r plus, it looks very much like the Schwarzschild type solution, at least as far as TR theta phi are concerned. As r goes to r plus, GTT goes to zero, GRR blows up. The size of the two spheres is finite, and the size of the internal dimension is finite. So, you know, there's nothing too unfamiliar going on there. But now I want to look at the extremal limit. So usually, when you have solutions that are charged, there tends to be the generic solution, and then as you try and charge them up, in the case of Riesen and Nordström, you have two event horizons, inner and outer. As you add more and more charge, the two come closer together till they coincide just before they disappear, and you get a naked singularity. Here, we're strongly suspicious of R minus. We think it's a singularity, but never mind. It's another root in the metric. But as r plus goes to r minus, what happens here is that singularity coming and joining with the event horizon, rendering the space-time singular. What's going on? So the extrema limit is r plus is equal to r minus. So that's the same as q. And I'm going to look at the special case of n equals 1. Okay. Now I'm just going to relabel my extra dimension for reasons that will become apparent. I'm basically going to scale out that length so that now my new angular coordinate chi just looks like an angle. Oh, this chalk doesn't seem to like me at all. Okay, so if r plus is equal to r minus, gtt is now just 1. I've actually lost my event horizon, or at least I looks like I might have lost it. I've still got something going on in the radial coordinate, and now my angular pieces actually fit together in a much more sort of comfortable way. So let's look at what happens as we tend to this r plus, right? Because at first sight, it looks like, you know, this, it's certainly coordinate singularity, but is it a real singularity? Is it an event horizon? What's going on? We're suspicious it's not going to be an event horizon because of GTT, but we better just check what's going on. So we've seen this sort of thing before. We've kind of seen it when we were thinking about the Euclidean black hole solution. When we went towards 2GM there, or r plus, we redefined our radial coordinate. So let's just try the same trick here. We know that setting this to rho squared changes that rho to being the proper distance, but what else happens? So as we tend to r plus, these two pieces get the common factor of r plus squared, and what's sitting out in front all kind of boils down to just the rho squared, well, rho squared on 4. So now what we've got near rho equals 0 is something that's just purely made up of angles. So what is it? So I'm going to redefine, I'm just going to define 4 coordinates, x, y, z, and w. And I'm defining them in terms of my rho theta, or a rho, a theta, a chi, and a phi. And now I'm going to say, let me just look at the Cartesian flat space metric in terms of this, you know, dx squared plus dy squared, etc. So what does the flat space metric give me? Well, you can see that obviously from this, I'm going to get a d rho squared, I'm going to get a rho squared on 4 d theta squared. So those two pieces are easy to read off. And because there's so many halves sitting around, pretty much anything when I take the angular variation is going to give me rho squared on 4. So now I look at what else I get. From the top, I get cos squared theta on 2 times d chi squared. So that's the variation of the angle here. And then from the other one, then I just get a combination of phis and chis. So if I kind of look what's happening inside that square bracket now, and I think there should be a d theta squared sitting as well. My d chi squared is just simply d chi squared. Then if I look at the d phi squared, I've got sine squared theta over 2. So I simply use one of those trig relations that tells me how, you know, what is it? 2 sine squared theta over 2 is 1 minus cos theta or something like that. So that's what I get for the other pieces. And then if I look at that and put it all together, so I complete the square with my chi coordinate, I've now got exactly what I was looking for. And then what's left over is d theta squared. And then once I take care of the phi terms, my sine squared theta d phi squared. So in other words, what I've done is I've actually demonstrated explicitly that what's sitting inside the square brackets here is an S3 metric. So I've given you a coordinate transformation that takes this to the origin of R4. So that means that as rho goes to 0, this metric is completely non-singular. So these angles here are the Euler angles. So we can represent S3 in quite a variety of ways, but these are using Euler angles to essentially, you know, if you think about what is a rotation and how do you represent a rotation, you know, then you can represent it using Euler angles.
You have a couple of those, theta is divided by 2 and chi is divided by 2. Does this impose problems with like boundary conditions or
boundary conditions?
The periodicity of the angles.
No, this is just, I'm just kind of, so my chi has periodicity 4 pi. So as chi goes to 4 pi, I've just got 1 here. And phi to 2 pi, I've got the same thing here. So so this metric is actually completely non-singular. So it's called the Kaluza-Klein monopole. And it's down to Gross, Perry, and Raphael Sorkin, who again, perimeter. So there you go. So this is really a very nice solution because it gives you an example of non-trivial non-trivial piece of mathematics or topology here. You might think, if you look at the metric here, where's the extremal one? Here we are. You might think as you go to infinity, what does it look like? Dt squared minus dr squared minus r squared d omega squared. And then this funny thing here. It's just, d chi squared times a factor. So from the Kaluza-Klein perspective, locally, it looks like you've got your S2, theta phi, and a little S1. So it looks locally like S2 cross S1. But what this is saying is that the S1, as you tack on the S1, the presence of this extra phi piece means that you're doing a little twist. You don't see it locally, you just see the S1 locally, but if you go all the way round, say a great circle of your two sphere, you see that the twist gradually goes from zero to kind of a full twist of 2 pi, and so you've done something non-trivial with your vibration of the S1. So it's an example of what's called a hop vibration. So it's sort of one of these sort of interesting ways that you can construct higher dimensional manifolds. And it's quite a special thing. It happens with S3 and S7, I think. But it's sort of quite neat. Locally, you think you've got just a little extra dimension tacked on, but globally, you've got a very different topology indeed. So that's the Kaluza-Klein monopole. And I sort of recommend or refer you to the original papers on the subject. And in Malcolm and David's paper, they actually talk about what happens if n is not equal to 1. So then you get sort of not this nice smooth space. You get something which is known as Lens space, because you're kind of fibering your S1 with n twists rather than a simple twist. So now I want to look very quickly at stability issues. And specifically, the black string. So I'm moving on from the monopole. So what happens with Schwarzschild cross R? So remember, we've got our solution, which was Schwarzschild cross R. That was how I originally wrote it down. So let me give you an argument about why this could be unstable. Suppose this, we look at our cylinder, Schwarzschild cross R. And look at a length L of cylinder. And let me just write the radius as R4. The mass of this piece of cylinder is actually R4 over 2G4. Which, when I express it in terms of the five-dimensional Newton's constant, it's R4L over 2G5. So it's got this fixed amount of mass. So the entropy is the area of the event horizon, which is the area of the S2, the 4 pi r plus squared, times the length of the cylinder L. And again, it's divided by 4g. And that's 4 pi g m squared. So now let me look at the five-dimensional black hole. And I'm going to say it's got radius R5. So we know from what we did about higher dimensional black holes how to find its mass. So our five-dimensional black hole, remember, was the potential was looking like 1 minus R5 squared over R squared. So it's now 1 over R squared Newtonian potential. And so the mass is, if you remember, we had this relation d minus 2, ad minus 2, you know, over 16 pi g. So this is what our mass is. So our area of a 3 sphere should be a 3, not a 4. A very poor 3, is 2 pi squared, so that's the only thing that's left unlabeled there. The entropy is the area of the event horizon, 2 pi squared r cubed, divided by 4g. And so I want to rewrite that in terms of the mass. So on the one hand, I've got the cylinder that has entropy proportional to m squared. On the other hand, I've got the hole, which has entropy proportional to m to the 3 halves. So that indicates that as you vary the mass of an object, one of, you know, these, either the cylinder or the black hole, would be entropically preferred. So just crudely, the black hole is proportional to m to the 3 halves, black string proportional to m squared. So you might expect that the string is preferred for larger m. So larger m with respect to what? So let's actually compare the two. So I'm rewriting G5 as G4 times L so that I can do some cancellations. And I can see that, you know, if I follow everything through, I've got an 8 to the 3 halves. So that's sort of, if I, that's 2 to the 3 halves times sort of 4 to the 3 halves, which is 4. 2 cubed, which cancels off the 2s there. So my 3s come out to the 3 halves. I've got a 1 over root pi. And then everything else comes out in terms of a square root. So what that means is I can either think of it as things happening as m gets bigger, or as L gets bigger or smaller. So essentially, the black hole is preferred if the length gets too long or if the mass gets too small relative to a scale set by the length of the extra dimension. Okay, so this is telling me a sort of general suggestive result, yep?
Yeah, but like,
it's not critical.
Yeah, one of them might have more entropy than the other, but how do you know that one of them can be, like, can one of them become the other?
Yeah, well, I was sort of about to talk about it. So I said this is an argument based on entropy, okay? How have we justified this? We had two reasons for justifying entropy in terms of areas. The first one was a heuristic look at the parameter space of black hole solutions. We kind of looked at how areas changed, and we argued from that we could identify the area of the black hole with entropy if we did a sort of direct identification of varying the internal energy of the black hole and compared it to the thermodynamics, the sort of typical standard rules of thermodynamics. So that was one argument. Another argument, which I didn't highlight in lectures, but I think I have done in sort of questions outside of lectures, that is that classically black holes obey an area theorem. If you have positivity of energy, the area of a black hole always increases if you throw something across it. So that's, if you like, another supporting piece of evidence for entropy. However, the direct, you know, direct calculational evidence for entropy being a quarter of the area, we derive by using that Euclidean approach to quantum gravity or pseudo-quantum gravity. We took a Euclidean partition function for the Schwarzschild black hole and computed the entropy in terms of that. So it's all nice and it makes a very nice sort of theoretical picture, but this is now giving some definite indicator that a solution is unstable. And honestly, do we really feel that that's a good enough argument? You know, just coming at it cold. And I think you should be skeptical. And I think, well, one person already was a bit skeptical. So essentially, this is all very well, but is it true? So how would we find out if it was true? So if you ever want to see if a solution is stable, you just do perturbation theory. You say, let me wobble it a bit and see what happens. So what does that mean in the context of GR? You say that you take your metric and you wobble it. You add an extra piece where HAB is small. Now, there's an awful lot of machinery behind this, which, you know, how do you mean small, you know, how do you decide what's physical, et cetera, but let me just at least give you the sketch, the skeleton of the argument. So we've already done some of this work in the past. We know how to vary the Ricci tensor and the connection. And I do apologize for the notation because I know that H was also used as the first fundamental form, but it's just this seems to be the standard notation for perturbation theory in GR. So that's what we get for delta RAB. And notice that this, in terms of indices, again, abstract index, this C is taking a divergence, but it's got a covariant derivative between it and the H. So we use the Riemann identity. To reduce this, so basically, we symmetrize on A and B because it's the Ricci tensor is symmetric, and we get a whole string of things. I'll just write it down again in a different format. So I've kind of skipped a couple of steps there. I've used the Riemann identity to change the ordering of covariant differentiation on the metric perturbation, and in doing so, I pick up Riemann tensor pieces. So that's how the Riemann tensors got in there. But because I've got the contraction over that C index, one of the Riemann pieces actually turns into a Ricci tensor. So that explains the Ricci piece that's sitting in there as well. So writing it out, you see that what you get is variation of the Ricci is the direct wave operator acting on H, a Riemann piece, a Ricci piece, and then everything else, where I've grouped that in terms of this H bar, where you take H, and in four dimensions, this would be trace reversed H, but it's just a collection of the perturbation, and it's actually a pure gauge term. You can gauge it away. And we write this just as a single operator, Lichnerowicz operator, which is the curved space wave operator for this spin 2 particle, the H. So a gauge transformation, which is x mu goes to x mu plus psi mu, where psi is presumed sort of infinitesimal. If I change coordinates, I actually get a change in my metric components in general, unless I change them along a killing vector. So a change of coordinates actually induces a perturbation, right, in terms of a delta G. So we really do have to be careful when we're doing gravitational perturbation theory. A simple change of coordinates will change the metric. How do we know we've done anything physical? So this is also a real issue in cosmology, because in cosmology, you want to make sure you've identified real, honest-to-God perturbations. So you also have to worry about these issues. So in the context of the black string instability, this is schematically what it looks like. So this piece is like a Fourier mode. This piece is what's telling you it's unstable. It's an exponentially growing mode. And this piece is just in the TR theta phi directions, the four dimensions. And it's what's called an S wave, which means there's no angular dependence and nothing going on to sort of change the angular, the spherical symmetry of the problem. So that's how you know it's not gauge. The fact that it's a spherically symmetric mode that has this Z dependence. So it looks like a perturbation from the four-dimensional perspective that is massive because of the mu squared term, and it's spherically symmetric. So it looks like, if you like, a longitudinal mode for the graviton.
What does this H mean? What is this solution of?
I'm only giving it schematically, so I'm just trying to illustrate that I've said that we use perturbation theory to explore whether something is stable or not, and I'm saying this is what the instability looks like. The instability has a Fourier mode in the extra direction. It's unstable, so it has to have an e to the omega t, an exponentially growing mode. What's left is just a function of r, and it's obviously a tensor mode, but it's an S wave, so it has to respect the spherical symmetry. So this is all it can do. And then what you do when you want to analyze it, you say that you can also take H lambda lambda is zero, and therefore H lambda mu, the divergence of H, is directly zero. So although it looks like there are four functions sitting in there, here are kind of three relations. So you can get everything down to a single function. So everything reduces down to a single second order nonlinear ODE in the radial coordinate. And so what you do, the omega and mu give an eigenvalue problem. And so what you do is you integrate this equation numerically and just look to see, is there any, for a given mu, is there any omega that solves the equation? And the answer is yes. There's a fixed range of omega mu for which there's a solution. It looks something like this. And so again, for smaller mass or relatively larger L, the black hole is preferred, so you would expect the instability to occur. And sure enough, it does. There's a finite range of low masses, or you know, low mass relative to the length, for which you get an instability. And so the interpretation, because it's an S wave and with a given frequency in the extra dimension, is that it looks something like this. That's what the, if you look at what happens to the event horizon starts to ripple. So, in, you know, that's just a linear argument, but in fact, it says classical perturbation theory has completely backed up this sort of rather more, you know, highfalutin type of argument coming from a sort of quantum gravity type of approach. So there is a black string instability, and what happens, well, I refer you to a lovely paper by Lewis, who's here at Perimeter, and Hans Pretorius, who actually did a real sort of, took several months of numerical integration to actually follow this instability into the nonlinear regime. And they sort of see a, almost a fractal-like behavior, but they do sort of seem to see things like, you know, black holes forming, you know, with little, ever smaller little arrays of black, smaller black holes in between. So there's a lovely cascade of the instability. You sort of get, first of all, a major peeling off of larger black holes, and then gradually along what remains, if you like, of the event horizon in between, there seem to be smaller cascade of smaller black holes. So they've got some nice animations on the web, so I recommend that you Google that and have a look at them. It's a lot of fun, and it's an impressive piece of numerical relativity. Okay.